In this segment, we will present some definitions and describe the application of evidence-based medicine. I've always liked this diagram that appeared in a paper in 1997. I think it puts the use of evidence in the proper context. Basically, evidence is one part of what goes into making a clinical decision. So for evidence, we need to know what the research shows, the results of things like randomized trials and systematic reviews. But there's other factors that go into making a clinical decision. We have factors about the patient and or the physician, their cultural beliefs, their personal values, their experience, their education. Patients may have preferences. Physicians may have limitations in the skills that they have, particularly if it's physicians in rural areas or places where the entire spectrum of medical services is not available. There are also constraints on making clinical decisions. We have formal policies and laws, community standards. There may be issues of time. We may not have time because the patient is acutely ill to do what the absolute best evidence would support. And of course, issues of reimbursement. So it's those three different factors that influence the actual decision that we make, and evidence is only part of that. There are many great resources for evidence-based medicine. Not only do they give good descriptions of how to practice it, but they also demystify a lot of the ideas and the techniques behind it. There are many books that I would list three as among the major books. One of these is the book by Strauss et al. This was formerly known as the Sackett book and was really the original book on evidence-based medicine authored by David Sackett of McMaster University before he retired. And Strauss is now the editor of the book, now in its third edition. There are also two books by Guyot et al., several of whom are also from McMaster's. These books come from a series of articles published in JAMA under the broad heading of User's Guides to the Medical Literature. In 2008, the second editions of these two books came out. One of them is a small handbook. The larger is a more encyclopedic reference about evidence-based medicine. There are also plenty of websites that are available about evidence-based medicine, and I list some of those here. Evidence-based medicine has been evolving over the years. And in 1999, I wrote a paper that observed this trend. The initial approach to evidence-based medicine that I noted, which I called first-generation EBM, was the idea that a clinician would actually find and critically appraise evidence as he or she was applying it in the clinical setting. So the clinician would go out, find the article, critically appraise it, and then make the clinical decision. Well, it became readily apparent that that process took way too much time, especially in the busy clinical setting, and that not all clinicians had the expertise, even if they had begun to be trained in evidence-based medicine, to really understand the study design, the nuances of the statistics, and so forth. So the more recent approach, which I call the next generation of evidence-based medicine, was more the use of synthesis and synopsis of evidence for the clinician, making it more imperative to provide the clinician with online, up-to-date information that makes the application of evidence in clinical decisions easier. Slauson actually takes this a step further, arguing that we shouldn't even really be talking about the different kinds of evidence and how to critically appraise it, but instead we should put more emphasis on teaching information management, seeking, the kinds of things we'll cover in Unit 7, the kinds of things actually that I do my research on. However, I still believe that there's value in understanding evidence-based medicine, of knowing how to critically appraise information and how to find that information and apply it and to understand what went into the appraisal. Another viewpoint concerning evidence comes from Brian Haynes, whose name you'll see peppered throughout this unit. The kinds of questions that we think about when we apply evidence or when we're assessing either a treatment or a diagnostic test: can it work? Does it work? And is it worth it? So first we ask about a study: can it work? And these are what we typically call efficacy studies. These are studies that take place under ideal conditions, so a randomized controlled trial in a clinical area, in not necessarily an academic medical center, but typically so. The patients are followed closely, they're monitored, a lot of data is collected about them. And efficacy studies are the studies that help us determine whether tests or treatments work. And evidence-based medicine mostly focuses on those kinds of studies. We then ask, does it work? These are sometimes called effectiveness studies, where we look at whether something works in the real world. This used to go by the name outcomes research, although that name is a little bit passé now. But the idea is that we would actually see if something worked when it was put in the hands of a much larger segment of the clinical provider population. And then the final question in this framework is it worth it? So we do either cost-benefit or cost-effectiveness studies to see whether the benefits are worthwhile in relation to the cost of a test or a treatment. Another way to look at evidence is to look at the hierarchy of evidence. And one approach shows the different types of evidence that clinicians use for decision making. This model, developed by Brian Haynes, originally started as the 4S model, and that model is the simplest. He subsequently divided some of the levels into additional levels, so updated it to the 5S and 6S model, but really this basic one is preferred. The foundation of evidence is studies, that is, original research that's done, written up in articles, and published in medical journals. However, for many topics, especially common diseases and common treatments, there'll be many, many studies, so we need to synthesize these studies. So the next level in the hierarchy is syntheses, and the best syntheses are ones that are called systematic reviews, which will be described in a later segment, also sometimes called evidence reports, that systematically review all of the evidence for a given clinical question. These syntheses, however, can be quite substantial in length, and a busy clinician really might want to get to the gist of the evidence. So the next level in the hierarchy is synopses, which are sometimes called evidence-based abstractions, where the key points are abstracted out of the comprehensive synthesis. Finally, the highest level of evidence is systems, and this is where we actually have actionable knowledge. Knowledge that is taken from the synopses can be put into a logical form and used, ideally, by electronic systems to automatically guide decision making. So where does the evidence come from? Depending on the level, there's different types of evidence, and in the slides that follow this one, we'll go into a number of these in detail. I'll also point out that in Unit 7 on information retrieval, we talk a lot about the searching of these resources and ways to access the information. But let's take a look at the different levels of evidence and where the evidence actually comes from. So starting at the level of studies, this evidence usually comes from the medical literature. And so we usually start by accessing the literature, going into literature databases such as Medline, which is a database of the medical literature. So we retrieve the studies from actual journals. A great fraction of medical journals are now available electronically, although we may not have a subscription to them, so we may need to pay in some way. And when we find the articles, we apply critical appraisal, the various formulae that we'll go through, things like relative risk, number to treat, sensitivity, odds ratio, etc. The next level up is syntheses, which are typically systematic reviews or sometimes called evidence reports. So these are exhaustive reviews of the data on a given topic, and these are done in a very systematic manner. So it's not just a simple literature review of bringing together all the papers that an author knows about or was able to find in a single Medline search. They're very comprehensive. And there may, where appropriate, be the application of meta-analysis. And meta-analysis is when we combine the results of multiple similar studies into a single analysis. So these studies have to be appropriately similar, and there are actually methodologic means to assess whether studies are similar enough. And so if there have been 15 different trials looking, different clinical trials looking at surgery or medical treatment for back pain or cancer or whatever, a specific type of cancer, we can combine those studies. Again, they have to be similar enough. They have to have similar interventions, perhaps similar patient groups, and we can then combine them in a meta-analysis. Meta-analysis can be done not only for treatments, but also for diagnostic tests, prognosis, and so forth. Synopses, then, are highly summarized information that's appropriate for the clinical setting. So just giving us the answer. After all, we may be in a busy clinical environment and we have a patient with back pain and we want to know what the evidence shows for this treatment or that treatment. We don't necessarily want to know all of the many different studies that have been done, how they've been combined, and we don't necessarily want to go down into the individual studies because for many topics there have been many studies and it would be inappropriate to pull out a single one when there are so many different ones. And so synopses are available in things like critically appraised topics or CATs as they're sometimes called. There are publications such as the book and CD-ROM called Clinical Evidence. InfoPoems is another resource peer, and we'll talk about these when we talk about synopses in more detail. And clinical practice guidelines fall into the synopses category. The highest level in the hierarchy is systems, so basically decision support systems within electronic health records, and that's probably the best way to actually provide evidence to clinicians where they're actually making decisions. And we talked in Unit 4 about decision support and how it's used and some of its limitations, but that would be the highest level of knowing the context of the patient care and providing the evidence to the clinician to use that information in providing clinical care. So how is evidence-based medicine applied? One of the things I hope to do in this unit is, particularly for those of you who don't have much exposure to evidence-based medicine, is demystify it a little bit. Sometimes for those who are unfamiliar with it, it seems a little inaccessible. But basically, this is the overview of applying evidence-based medicine, the steps listed on this slide. So the first thing that we need to do in evidence-based medicine, and doesn't always get enough attention as critical appraisal of articles and finding them and applying them, but phrasing a clinical question that's pertinent and answerable. And we'll go through these steps more and then actually see how these steps are carried out in the individual types of clinical questions. So then the second step is identifying the evidence to address the question. And then the third step is critically appraising the evidence to determine if it applies to the patient. We'll spend less time doing critical appraisal, although we'll go into detail with it where when we talk about interventions, but all of the references that I pointed you to several slides back describe the process of critically appraising the evidence, although as we move from that first generation of evidence-based medicine to the next generation, the critical appraisal is done less and less by the individual physician and is done more and more by those who have the time and expertise to do it and then published as syntheses and synopses. So let's talk about phrasing the clinical question. We'll go through this in the next few slides. But one way to view clinical questions is to distinguish between background and foreground questions. So background questions are general kinds of questions that come up in the care of patients. And these are usually answered without using evidence-based medicine techniques. We look them up in a textbook or perhaps seek out a more classic review article that's not something like a systematic review. Foreground questions are when we ask for knowledge about managing patients with specific disorders and we're contemplating a test or a treatment, and these are the ones that are usually answered with evidence-based medicine techniques. So let's explore these a little further. So sometimes background questions are general information that is not specific to a given patient. What causes pneumonia? What are the types of things that usually cause pneumonia? Bacteria, viruses, sometimes chemical pneumonia, things like that. Another example question is, when do the complications of diabetes usually occur? How long does one have the disease before you start to see kidney problems, heart problems, etc.? It turns out that the distinction from foreground questions is actually a little bit blurry. It's not quite as distinct as one might hope. For example, there are new etiologies of disease that come along, and we may want to know if they're the cause of a disease, and in fact, we'll devote some time to looking at cause of disease, or sometimes called harm, things that are harmful. And it also depends a little bit on your level of training. If you're a subspecialist, something may be more of a foreground question as opposed to being a student when almost everything is new and many things tend to be a foreground question. So the distinction, like many things in informatics, is a little blurry. But it's important to understand a clinical question and phrasing a clinical question to find the best evidence. And that's when we talk about foreground questions. Foreground questions have either three or four essential components. And since many people remember things in medicine by remembering acronyms, one way to remember these components is the PICO acronym. So a complete foreground question has a patient and or a problem. There's an intervention. It may be a treatment. It may be a diagnostic test. There's a comparison intervention, if appropriate. And then there's some sort of outcome. So if it's a treatment question, we have a patient with a disease. We do a specific treatment. If we're looking for evidence, we find perhaps a randomized controlled trial that compares that treatment with a control or a placebo group. And then there's some kind of outcomes. Either the treatment is more effective or less effective than the control or placebo. With a diagnostic test, we may look at how accurate the test is, so we're comparing against some sort of gold standard. with something like prognosis, how patients do, we may not necessarily have a comparison. We just follow the natural history of a disease. So here's an example of a foreground question. In an elderly patient with congestive heart failure, so where the heart's not pumping as strongly as it could, are beta blockers, which are a type of drug, a category of drug, helpful in reducing morbidity and mortality, so complications and death, without excess side effects? And one of the reasons why I actually throw up this question is those of you who may be clinical old-timers like me remember a time when it was considered anathema to put a patient with congestive heart failure on beta blockers, which actually reduce the strength of the heart. But it turns out in that many situations in congestive heart failure, that's exactly what you want to do. And so I put this question here to also remind you and me that evidence changes over time. New evidence comes along. So we have to be cognizant of that when we think about applying evidence and when we look for evidence that what was previously the established dogma may no longer be the case. So there are four categories of foreground questions. Most clinical questions fall into these buckets. Some of them don't fall exactly into them. We'll see some examples of questions that span more than one of these. But these are, in essence, the major four kinds of questions that get asked in clinical settings and that, as informaticians, we want to help people find the answers to. So the first category, I actually like to call it intervention, although many of the textbooks call it therapy. And this category looks at the benefit of interventions that we do, such as treatment or prevention of disease. That's another type of intervention when we apply preventive medicine. We're intervening. So I like intervention better, although this is classically called therapy. Diagnosis is when we look at some way of diagnosing disease, typically with a test, although the test, we commonly think of things like a blood test, but any kind of maneuver on a physical examination is a diagnostic test, an x-ray, etc. So there's many types of diagnostic tests. Oftentimes we want to know what caused the disease. This is sometimes called the etiology of a disease, and the evidence-based medicine categories usually caused harm. What causes harm to a patient? Sometimes harm is caused to a patient in the form of an intervention, and we may do studies to look at that. And then finally, the last major category is prognosis. What is the outcome of the disease course? So when we find a piece of evidence, a study, we ask three questions. Are the results of the study valid? Are the results important? That is, did the results show that some treatment or test is efficacious? And then can the results be applied to patient care? So we also have to determine if the results from a study can be applied to a specific patient. If the study was done with a different age group, a different gender, the results may or may not be applicable, and that's typically a judgment call, but we have to think about that question. And then there are many sub-questions within these three broad categories that we ask about each study, and that depends on the type of question, like whether it's an intervention question or diagnosis or harm. And then we also may ask different questions based on the type of study that we have. We may have a systematic review, or we may have a randomized controlled trial, etc. So in the next few segments, we'll look at the different types of clinical questions and how we look at studies, how we look at evidence for answering those questions. Another hierarchy that we talk about in evidence-based medicine is the hierarchy of study designs. Many authors have come up with different levels for these study designs. You see them in the table on this slide. And the higher the level, the increasing validity of the design. So when we're doing experiments, the best experiment, the most valid type of experiment is a randomized controlled trial. In a randomized controlled trial, there's an equal probability that a subject is assigned to either an experimental condition or a control condition, and the researchers make every attempt to control any other factors that may influence the outcome so that the resulting outcome is ideally, anyways, due to the assignment to the experimental or control group. We can't always do randomized control trials. Sometimes it's even unethical to do them. So the next level of evidence is the cohort study. This is a prospective study where we look at groups who have been exposed or not exposed to a factor. Of course, because since they're not randomized, the individual may have some other reason why they had a particular outcome, and it may not necessarily be due to exposure to the factor. The third level is case control studies. These are retrospective studies where we look back and we identify cases and match them with controls and see if there's more exposure to some factor, whether it's a treatment or a harmful agent or whatever. Of course, this even further can be confounded by factors that we may not even know about. The next level of study design is a case series where we just observe a group without any controls whatsoever. And of course, here we don't even have much to compare an experimental group with a control group. And then finally, there are studies like experimental opinion, physiologic studies, and these are only as good as the expert or the underlying knowledge that we have of physiology.